Welcome back. Today's challenge is, does anybody know where we're up to? Before we begin, just a brief word. I can't just go straight into things, considering that since we last met, Rosh Hashiva passed away, and I'm not going to turn the shir into hesbah. Just one little aspect I wanted to share that somebody reminded me of the last few days. That amongst the way the Hashiva conducted himself when he was giving shiurim, he always encouraged the fellows to participate. And he had tremendous anivus. You know, he talked to the fellows as if they were equals, practically. And sometimes the downside of that is that guys used to get carried away. Sometimes you get a fellow who gets pretty stubborn in his arguments. He's not being mekabel. So Rishiva used to say a couple of different things to try to get them to listen. So one of the lines that he used was, "Listen, I can't blame you. I had a better Rebbe than you had." That was one of his lines. And another thing he said from time to time, that he used to tell the story about his mother, I think it was, who had some type of a wound in her foot that wasn't healing, and went to a doctor who was an experienced older doctor, and he looked at it and said, "You know, give it time, the wound will heal." He went to a different doctor, a second opinion, a younger doctor, who was more state-of-the-art, and he insisted that it was not going to heal and it could spread, and that it had to be, the foot had to be amputated. But he decided to go along with the older doctor. About 2 weeks later, it looked even worse. Instead of healing, it was getting worse. So he went back to the doctor. He said, "Don't worry, it happens like that, it'll heal." The younger doctor said, "Look, you see, I told you so. We better get operated right away." But he still went along with it. And time went on, the wound healed. There was no, it turned out not to be necessary to amputate. So he said, "I have no doubt that this young doctor was very bright, probably better educated than the older doctor, more familiar with the state of the art. But sometimes there's just no substitute for experience. So I have more experience than you. I'm sure you're a fine lamdan. Experience is worth something." So just little vignettes with the way he used to conduct himself in that type of atmosphere. People were not afraid, you know, to ask their questions or to try to present their opinions. They weren't going to get obliterated. Sometimes they deserve to be, but didn't they? Okay, we are, I keep notes, so I know where we're up to. We are at Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Yud Dalet. To reset the stage, the first part of the Perek was describing the so-called Chet of Shama. There are varying opinions that it was, but as to what it was, but the predominant opinion was that Shlomo did not sufficiently, in his older years, supervise his wives, and they surreptitiously began to introduce different avodah zarahs, and he wasn't on top of them enough to stop it, and that was the result of, to some sense, to some level, his deadening his sensitivities. And it came ultimately from the fact that he had too many wives. So that was the chet of Shama. We had discussed earlier that there are other aspects. Shlomo also was marvis susim with the Torah, says the king shouldn't do. There is some dispute, the difference between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, whether he was also held to task for having too much money. But too many wives, too many horses, which led to this introduction of avodah zarah, and possibly too much money. We mentioned the machlokas. The Bavli does not mention it. Yerushalmi does, and the various explanations of the Bavli were that perhaps the isser of taking too much money is only if you take it in the form of taxes, because it puts a burden on Kal Yisrael. But Shlomo got his money through other means, Or another explanation given was that it's only if you have money that you don't need. But since Shlomo had so many wives and so many horses and such a large apparatus, so he needed the money. But so the only kind was having the wives and the horses in the first place. So that is the two opinions. On the Bavli, we mentioned that it's a little bit hard to hear the second approach. They needed the money because we have the psukim that said that silver was worth nothing, and they're like stones. So obviously they had more than they needed. So we left with that question and that approach. So we're up to Pasuk Yudalit. As a consequence of Shlomo's, we'll call it chait, but let's understand that it wasn't so simple. As a consequence of Shlomo's actions, Vayokam Hashem Satan l'Shlomo, Hashem caused there to arise an adversary to Shlomo, Ace Hadad HaEdomi, that's Hadad the Edomi, that's from Esav, Mizera HaMelech HuBedom, he was the descendant of the king of Edom. So what does it mean, an adversary? It meant that they started having border troubles, they started having little wars, issues, etc., which did not take place. And we remember at the beginning of Shlomo's rule, it said, "Vayeshu Yisrael Avetach Ein Satan." There was no problems. But now that there was chait, so there were problems. Now, actually, the Mefarshim view this as a fulfillment of Hashem's promise to David, and in a certain sense, really, as a kind of interesting way, a form of chesed that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did for Klal Yisrael. What's the chesed to have these tzaras? So in the Nevuah to David, when David was being promised that his descendants would remain on the throne, it said that as long as you follow the ways of Hashem, you will have, everything will be good, and if not, you will have trouble. I will chastise you with the shevet, the stick, the rod of people, and nigei b'nei adam, and plagues that affect humanity. So, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu would not respond to the chait, then what would normally happen, of course, it's always possible the person will realize on his own that he's going off and do tshuva, but typically human beings don't do that. As long as everything's going well, they continue merrily along their path, and it will only get worse and worse. And then by the time HaKadosh Baruch Hu gets around to being pokeyed, the din, the chait is very serious. But by instantly responding with some type of a problem, lo'chiach b'shevet anashim v'nigei b'nei adam, so then it arrests the process. Then immediately people have tzaras, they start thinking about it, they do tshuva, or to a certain degree do tshuva, they stop getting worse at least. So this type of response is helpful. And in fact, the Malbim suggests that is the reason why the Malchus stayed in Beis David. Even though it was limited, and as the punishment was going to be that part of the kingdom was taken away, but part of the kingdom remained. Had HaKadosh Baruch Hu not interceded in this way and punished Shlomo, it would have gotten worse, and they would have ended up having to lose the entire movement. And in Malchus Yisrael, we find that the kings did not pass the Malchus on to their children. I mean, sometimes you had a dynasty of several generations, but eventually the kings did not pass the Malchus on to their children. And also the Malchus Yisrael was destroyed before Malchus Yehuda, and more of it was lost. It's a very confusing issue. I know people are trying to do research on it. What happened to Aseres HaShvatim? We always have these people who pop up in various weird places of the world and claim that they are descendants of Aseres HaShvatim, whether they're black or Chinese or whatever they may be. But clearly, they were lost to a greater degree than Malchus Yehuda. By the way, just for the record, the opinion of most Rishonim, based on various contradictions in the Gemara, was that a segment, at least, of all the Aseres HaShvatim were returned to Eretz Yisrael. And we do have descendants today from every one of the 12 Shvatim. The majority they didn't get their land back, they didn't come in large numbers, but the, in some dispute exactly when this happened, but it did seem to happen. The majority of Klal Yisrael today is, if they're not Kohanim and Leviim, are from Shevet Yehuda and Binyamin. But there are representatives of all the other Shvatim, so you guys cannot be sure. I'm a Levi, but if you can't be sure that you're from Yehuda and Binyamin, it is possible to come from another Shevet. But by interceding in Malchus Beis David and punishing them immediately, it prevented the situation from getting out of hand. I once heard in the name of Elia Lapian, and I did do a little computer research to see if I could find this. I think it's supposed to be a chazal that it was based on, but I could not find it. I didn't have that much to go on because I don't know the exact language, you know, of the chazal. You have to start looking for the language. I could have put Noach and Mabul in, but then you get like thousands of responses. But I heard over said in the name of Elia Lapian, he said, Pshat, there's a medrash that says something to the effect that Sheker wanted to get onto the Teva. Right? The Malach of Sheker wanted to get onto the Teva and came to Noach. And Noach said, I can't accept you because everyone has that Shnayim Shnayim. You have to come in twos. You have to have a mate. So the medrash goes on. Sheker was trying to find a partner. Went to this. He didn't want to do it. Finally, they got a partner. The partner was chaos, destruction. I think the language is Paziza, but I couldn't find it. So they came as a couple and they were admitted to the Teva. So Rav Elia Lapian explained that you had a very interesting situation called Mamabo. It says about Timalei Haaretz Chamas. The world was full of corruption, of dishonesty, of thievery, robbery. There was total degeneration, and yet society functioned just fine. And you don't find that society was breaking down. You had countries, you had economies, you know, things are going and left and right. People were stealing, robbing, cheating, you know. Almost sounds like America. Anyway, society was going on just fine. And there was no problems. That doesn't really happen. Normally, when things get to a certain point of corruption, society breaks down and you have chaos. And you have wars and civil wars and revolutions and something happens. He says that before the Mabul, the world was constructed in such a way that it was possible. You could have total corruption and life goes on. So what happens? Society gets worse and worse and worse. Nothing stops them. Nothing causes any change. People become more entrenched in their ways, and typically the Yitzhahara gets them to go worse and worse, and then it gets to the point that the world had to be destroyed. So Kadosh Baruch Hu's plan was never to destroy the world again. But how could he do that? If people sin, they have Bechira, people decide to sin and plummet into Chet, then the world maybe has to be destroyed. So how could Kadosh Baruch Hu promise not to destroy the world again? So the answer is, he made a marriage between Sheker and chaos, so that if things actually get bad enough, before it gets to the level that the world has to be destroyed, society will break down. People will take care of themselves. They'll fight with each other, kill each other. Some of the Rishonim will be killed off. People will see that this doesn't work. The tshuva find a new way of mode of behavior. And society will regenerate itself at a somewhat better level. So it'll never come to the point that the world has to be destroyed. So because Rokhu sits back and lets you do what you want, that's not necessarily a bracha. It could get worse and worse and worse. And here, in a global scale, the world comes to a point that it needs to be destroyed. So he creates society now in such a way that when it gets bad enough, then you'll have all kinds of wars and warlords and murders and killings and mayhem. And society, after a while, sort of cleanses itself. You can't continue like that. People can't take it. So then they reorganize and do tshuva and try to set things straight. Sometimes it takes a while. You look around the world today, you see this happening in many different localities where society is totally broken down, and then you have all these kinds of fighting and wars and bombings, you know, and then something, you know, after time, you know, people just can't take it anymore, and they reach some semblance of order and some type of improvement. So it prevents the necessity of having a total type of mabul that will destroy the world. It's an important attitude even for us on a less global scale, because it kind of is an eye-opener to the role of tsaras, illness, of problems, financial, whatever they may be. So we're not very pleased when these types of things happen to us. And sometimes we have tainus to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we feel angry. Why do we deserve such a thing? But in reality, it's quite possible that it's a gift. That a person gets a punishment, a person has difficulties in this world, it forces him to examine, or at least it opens his eyes to the possibility of examining or re-examining his ways. And it might bring him to improve himself so that it's not necessary to be punished in the next world or to have more serious punishments. So if a person finds he has difficulties, they shouldn't look at it as a time to talk Kadosh Baruch Hu. It might actually be a gift. There is a reminds me a little bit. There's a Rabag in Sefer Yehoshua. It's a little bit out of place. It's sort of a tangential piece, but it's very Yisodist. I actually could tell you a little story behind it a little bit. That this Rabag is on the parsha where it talks about where Achan violated the Cherem of Yericho, and as a result, Klal Yisrael lost the next battle. So he discusses the issue of situations where we find that one person sins and other people get punished, which seems contrary to fairness. So that's where he gets into this. So what if an issue that I didn't have an answer for, and maybe there are other answers, but it didn't have an answer for many, many years, was the famous Chazal. Because I'll ask a stira. In one pasuk it says, "Lo yumsu avos al banim v'lo banim al avos," that a father doesn't die for the sins of a child, and a child doesn't die for the sins of the father. Another pasuk says, "Pokei davon avos al banim al bnei banim shleishan ribeim," that Hashem remembers the sins of the fathers for the sons, the grandsons, up to the fourth generation. So the Gemara asks this contradiction, and the Gemara answers, if the children do not follow in the father's footsteps, so then lo yumsu abanim al avos avos abanim. But if they follow the footsteps of the father and they continue the same sins, then it's poket avon avos abanim abnei banim. But the problem I had is, okay, you've answered the contradiction, but the Chor still isn't fair. And if the sons follow the father's footsteps, they obviously deserve to get punished for their own sins. But why are they getting punished for their father's sins? So let's say the father is a sinner, the son follows his footsteps and he does the same sin. So you're not being poked avon avos, you're punishing the son for his sin. If his father was a tzaddik, he would still get punished for his sin. So it seems that he gets an extra punishment because his father sinned too. So you're back to the question. It may be, technically, it's not a contradiction in the psukim, but where's the fairness? So this Rabag in Yehoshua discusses this issue as well. After explaining different possibilities in the Me'ilah of Achan, he says the possibility that Klal Yisrael was held accountable because they didn't post guards, watchmen, to make sure that nobody violated the Cherem, or they didn't have sufficient influence. Whatever he goes on to say what the issues are, Klal Yisrael Arevim. But then he says as follows, that the Pasuk of Poked Avon Avos is not talking about punishment in the Olam HaEmes. When you go up to Shemayim, in the Olam HaEmes, a person only gets punished for his own sins. There's no such thing as Poked Avon Avos. But in this world, it's Poked Avon Avos. Why? Because when a Kadosh Baruch Hu chooses to punish somebody in this world, he's actually attempting to do him a favor. It's a special schus that a person has to get punished in this world. Because there's still something he could do about it. He could do tshuva, he could change his ways. So the idea of a punishment is it's a wake-up call. It's a calling card. Change your ways. So he says, the first generation of sinners knows very well that they're doing the wrong thing. And at some level they probably feel guilt about it because they know they're not following the way their father did. So a relatively minor punishment would be sufficient to attract their attention, to possibly get them to do tshuva. But once you get to the second generation, it's more entrenched. My father did this too, what could be so bad? So it requires a stronger blow, a bigger clap, for the person to have a shot, being motivated to tshuva. But even the second generation is not so bad. He still has a grandfather, he knows that Zaidi didn't do this. When you get to the third generation, it's even worse. So it requires a greater chet. He says, beyond the fourth generation, he says, it doesn't get any worse. Because after four generations, people have no shaykhus to their ancestors. Some people could trace their yichus back, you know, they do genealogical research, they could find out who they are, but it really doesn't impact them emotionally or psychologically. That's why it only goes to four generations. So he says, Pokeh of all the votes is not really being punished for your father's sins. Hashem remembers the father's sins and gives you a more severe punishment as a favor to you, so that it should be sufficiently powerful to shake you up so that you might be tempted to do tshuva.
But on the other hand, would that person be punished less than Shemayim because it wasn't their fault they were taught to be bad?
That's quite possible. That's quite possible.
Does that change today because people are living longer and so many people have a lot of great-grandchildren?
But it still doesn't really go beyond four generations.
What?
It still doesn't go beyond four generations, I don't think. I would think it doesn't. So that's the Rabbag's explanation. It could be there are others, but the it's sort of based on this approach of looking at punishments as gifts, as favors. Now, Mefarshim point out that it's especially appropriate that the source of this satan is from Edom, because we know the very Edom is Esav. There's a very famous equation created by Yitzhak Avinu. When Yaakov came and got the bracha, and Esav came crying afterwards, there's nothing left for me. And basically, Yitzhak said there's an equation. For Rak Da'ol, when Klal Yisrael doesn't follow the Torah, then you will be able to prevail on them. When they follow the Torah, you will be their slaves. They will prevail over you. When they don't, you'll be able to get the upper hand. So here, Klal Yisrael was failing in a certain sense. Avodah Zarah was being introduced. So the source of the difficulty, the first source of difficulty at least, came from Edom to fulfill that equation. Now we have a reference, a little historical reference. Tanakh is one of the greatest sources of history, but it's not a history book. So if they tell you a historical event, it's for a purpose. So until this point, it wasn't necessary to tell the story. Now we're reverting back to an event that took place much earlier to explain the background of this particular satan, if you will. Pasuk Tesvav, Vayhi biyos David es Edom, and it was in the days that David was bothering, attacking Edom. Ba'alos Yov Sarat Saba, when Yov the Sarat Saba arose, the Kaber es Achalom, to bury the victims of the battle, Vayakos Achalom, he had destroyed, he had killed all the men. Let's take the two psukim together. Ki Sheshes Chadoshim Yashav Shem Yov v'chol Yisrael. For Yov was there for 6 months with all the Jews, Ad Hichris Kozach of Edom, until he destroyed all the males of Edom. So there are some redundancies. It says he was there for 6 months destroying the males, and then it says he went up. First it says, actually, he went up to bury the Chalolim. It sounds as if there were two trips. And what exactly was going on, and why did the Pasuk say he destroyed all the men? So Chazal tell us that it was a mistake on the part of Yoav to destroy only the men. He should have killed the women too. We know by Amalek, now this isn't really Amalek, so I'm a little bit confused about this. The Gemara seems to apply the rules of Amalek to Edom in general. But the mitzvah Mechias Amalek is not Edom, it's Amalek. And in fact, the Nevi'im tell us that Edom will be around in the days of Mashiach. So, but I guess some of the rules apply. When you are fighting Edom, apparently you should kill the men and the women. But it quotes the famous pasuk, Timcha Zecher Amalek. Now we know in the Torah there are no nekudos, there are no vowels. And the word Zecher, Zayin, Chaf, Reish, could also be read Zachar. So Yoav thought that the pasuk said, Timcha Zachar Amalek. And that's why he killed only the men. And according to some Mefarshim, thank you. All right, I don't have it written. I think, according to some of the Mefarshim, there were actually, oh yes, here it is, there were actually two wars. That first, the first battle, he killed only the men. This battle lasted 6 months. When he found out, then he came back to bury the dead, and the survivors of the first battle attacked again. And there was a second war. This time he killed the men and the women. And we'll see in the following pasuk, however, some people escaped. Hadad and others escaped with him. But that was what was going on. Now, why does the pasuk say he was there for 6 months? There is going to be a certain guilt attributed to Klal Yisrael for this action. Because since they killed only the men and not the men and the women, HaKadosh Baruch Hu allowed some of them to escape, and they eventually came back to haunt them. But why is it the responsibility of Klal Yisrael? So the Mefarshim say, Klal Yisrael and others, that 6 months was a lot of time. All this stuff was going on for 6 months. There's plenty of time for people to correct Yoav. First of all, the people in the army, they didn't all make this mistake. They knew what the halacha was. They should have gone to Yoav. Even David HaMelech, even though he wasn't in the battle, he was presumably getting reports. Now, they did not have instant messaging, or email, or any of that. But 6 months is quite a bit of time. And there should have been enough messages back and forth that Yoav could have, that David could have corrected Yoav. But they didn't. They left everything in the hands of Yoav. And as a result, this mistake was made. And therefore, Kadosh Baruch Hu did not give them full success in the operation.
And Yoav makes such a basic mistake.
Well, that's what they taught him. So the Gemara tells us that David HaMelech went to Yoav's Rebbe. Now, this is you talk about irate parents. Anybody who's been a Rebbe and had to face Pitain, you're lucky you didn't have to face David. So David wasn't a parent, but he was a cousin actually. But he went to Yoav's Rebbe. And again, it's not exact. We'll go through the different opinions exactly how to read the Gemara. But he confronted Yoav's Rebbe. Let's start with the Shad of the Rajba, the Ran, and the Ritva. He was testing Yoav's Rebbe to see if he knew how the pasuk read. So what does this pasuk say? What's the better answer? In what situation do you think that David would be more angry? If he got it right or if he got it wrong? So according to these Rishonim, David wanted to see if he got the answer right. If he got the answer wrong and he said Tipcha Zachar Amalek, so what could he do? He made a mistake. People make mistakes. He taught the pasuk to the class, to the children, as he himself had learned it or knew it. He made a mistake. You know, what could human beings make mistakes? But if he knew the correct pronunciation and he taught it as Zecher, and Yoav came out of the class thinking it was Zachar, that means he wasn't doing a good job teaching the class. The job of the Rebbe is to make sure that the students have learned what you taught them. So you may have said it right, but Yoav got it wrong. Why didn't you pick up on that? Why didn't you know that Yoav got it wrong? So David said, aha! You knew the pronunciation, you didn't do a good job. If that's the case, I'm going to have to kill you. Arur Osei Meleches Hashem Remia. Cursed is the person who does the work of Hashem in a cheating fashion. You get lazy as a teacher and you're not making sure your students are you deserve to die. So the Rebbe said, listen, if the pasuk says Arur, so why don't you just leave me with the Arur? I'm cursed, so I'm cursed. You have to kill me too. To which David answered, Arur monea charba midam. Cursed is the person who holds back his sword from dam, from blood. The person is supposed to act and he doesn't act, he's also ba'arur. Or at least that's one interpretation. The Gemara ends up that there's a machlokus. Yesh omrim, some say he killed him. V'yesh omrim, some say he didn't kill him. We'll get to that in a moment.
Well, who was his teacher?
Doesn't say his name.
No one will ever be a rabbi after that.
That's true.
What did he do to Yoav?
Nothing. That's how Yoav made it. Yoav thought this is what it meant.
He was taught wrong.
But what we see from here is a very, amongst other things, is a very important lesson about chinuch. First of all, there's a responsibility for the teacher has for every single individual in the class. We don't know what happened to the other members of the class. Maybe Yoav was the only one who got it wrong. It doesn't say that David went, got the student records, found out who this guy taught, and see where everybody else is holding. Maybe everyone else got it wrong, got it right for all David knew. But, so what? You're responsible to every student. There's no such thing as not being responsible for a student. Now, if the student himself refuses to cooperate, you know, that's always the way out. Student's fault, the parent's fault, okay. But Yoav apparently was a pretty good student. He accomplished quite a bit in life. So, it wasn't a chisaron mitzad Yoav, mitzad the teacher. But I got everybody else in the class. All right, it was a busy day. We were doing that pasuk. It was kind of hectic. You know, whatever it was, you know, it was Erev Rosh Chodesh. You had an assembly the next day. We were practicing the play. You know, I don't know. But it was hectic. So, well, I missed Yoav. How do you miss Yoav? You're a teacher. You have responsibility for every student.
Why isn't it the blame on David for not giving instructions to Yoav explicitly?
Well,
Yoav is a subordinate.
Yeah, right. But there was some time on David. We said not so much for not giving instructions because Yoav is a general. He takes care of things himself. But for not correcting him when he was getting the reports. But David didn't chase David. But the second thing you see is that part of teaching is knowing what the students know. The terminology for that today is feedback. Feedback and testing. Right? The reason why teachers test or listen to feedback is to find out whether the students have learned what you're teaching them.
But you can't have a class of every kid getting 100 and getting 100 years later.
Yeah. Well, that's because, but you see, Yoav was a very good student. It says Yoav was a tremendous Talmud Chacham. He was a very good student. And if he didn't get it, then it was the teacher's fault. I once conducted a little lesson in my own class in high school. If you're familiar with the way Gemara operates, there are certain, whatever you want to call it, glosses, mefarshim, on the side of the Gemara that track the various pieces of the Gemara to their sources in halacha. So you want to find out where the Gemara is found in the halacha, in the Rambam, in the Shulchan Aruch, you can find out. Also, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, so there are mefarshim who trace it back to the Gemara. The Rambam is a little less systematic. Usually the Nosakim trace it back to the Gemara as well. So, but I wanted to make sure the guys knew that. It's a tool you have to know how to use. So I spent the day discussing with them, explaining how you look things up. And then I gave them a quiz on it. I was afraid that the entire class was going to get 100 on the quiz. Because after all, it's very couple, one or two or three things, and it's very simple. And everyone's going to know it. So I didn't want to give a quiz. Everyone gave 100. So I put in one trick question. The one trick question was that if you find a certain halacha in this place in the Torah, where could you find it in the Shulchan Aruch? So I never actually told them that, but the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch are the same. So you find it in the same place. So if it's Simon Resh Pei Beis in the Torah, it's going to be Resh Pei Beis in the Shulchan Aruch. But I didn't tell them that. I figured some people will get that wrong, and that's it. I gave out get back the quiz. Not a single student passed. You're getting 20s, 30s, you know, 10s. Couldn't believe it. I said, if not a single student passed the test, it isn't their fault. It's my fault. You have to make sure you're getting through to the students. So what I did is I went back to it the next day, and I handed out photocopies of different Gemaras with Gemaras on the line and said, let's go look it up, do it. So they traced it back to the Ein Mishpat, they took out the Shulchan Aruch, they found the halacha, went to the Rambam, hands-on exercise. Next day I gave the quiz, everyone got 100. So first of all, a number of important things I learned from that. Number one, just because you think you've explained it doesn't mean that they understood it. This, of course, I've gotten many, many times in life. And I also learned that people don't learn like that. And that you talk about something, but it involves some actual technicalities. It goes in one ear, out the other. They don't absorb it. If you do it, then you get it. So the first time I just talked about it, very nice talk about this, whatever. I know it was something you look up here, down there. I don't know what it said exactly. When you do it, you've got it. You master it. So you have to find ways to make sure the students learn. But part of teaching is not teaching so that you understand it, but that the students understand it. I recall a situation, and I'm not going to mention any names or cities, although the person is no longer alive. I was visiting a yeshiva in some place, and the Rosh Yeshiva was saying a shir, and I sat in. It was in the middle of the shir. One of the boys asked a question, which I thought was a very good question, and this Rosh Yeshiva said, Gornish Kankasha. It's no question. He didn't even answer it. He went further. I was thinking about it, and I thought of an answer to the question. So I went over to this Rosh Yeshiva afterwards. I didn't know what he was going to do, but I figured I'm a guest anyway. I'm leaving town tonight. How bad could it be? But he was very, very nice to me. So I mentioned, one of the fellows asked this and this question. I was thinking maybe you could answer it like this. That's what I said. So he said, you're right. I thought of that answer. I had this question last night. So I thought of that answer. I also have a second answer. And he told me, a second answer. I walked away flabbergasted. That means it was a good question. And he had two answers. So why is he telling this guy, garnish kan kash, there's no kash, and why don't you just answer it? Give him the answers. And I realized that it was a whole different mentality. When he was saying a shir, he wasn't teaching Talmidim. He was telling you the MS of Torah. I'm telling you something about the Torah that you may not have known. So if somebody asks a question, they're saying that this Divrei Torah is wrong. Well, they're wrong. This Divrei Torah is right. There are two answers to that question. So it's Gornish Kankasha. But that's not teaching students. Like, why in the world would you be giving a shir like that? Just write up all your Divrei Torah, print the sefer. Whoever wants to read it could read it. But if you're teaching, then you have to make sure they understand. You have to have feedback. They have a question, you answer the question. By telling them it's not a question, the guy doesn't understand the shir then. You know that his question was wrong. Because you have this answer, you have that answer. Alright, it wasn't silly. So the idea of a teacher is not sufficient that you're telling the MS. Of course, that's step one. But you have to make sure that the students, as best of your ability, the students are learning. Otherwise, it's Arur Osem Lechaz Hashem Remia, and if David HaMelech is around, you're in deep trouble. There's another implication there, and that is the great importance of chinuch altogether. If there's such a dramatic response, Arus Malchus and Ramiya, and maybe he killed him, maybe he didn't kill him, but he threatened him at the very least, that's because it is such a critical job. This is the entire future of Kali Yisrael depends on chinuch, and it's a great, great responsibility. It's also a great, great tzchus. And therefore, it comes with its pluses and minuses. But it is certainly a very dramatic lesson as to how far it goes. Now the Marsha has a different interpretation of the Gemara. He says that it's the other way around, that the Rebbe himself got it wrong. And he is more of a defendant of the teaching staff. He says, if the Rebbe got it right and the student got it wrong, it isn't necessarily a proof that the Rebbe was doing Melechas Hashem Remia. He may have been trying his best, but as you said, not everyone gets 100 on the test. And maybe Yoav messed up. Yoav was a very good student. Even a very good student can mess up on occasion. So the fact that Yoav came out of the classroom with the wrong answer doesn't necessarily mean that the Rebbe was wrong, and therefore David wouldn't have reacted, unlike the other opinions. Rather, but if the Rebbe got it wrong, he says, then you should have realized that you're not qualified to teach. If you are making mistakes, and as the assumption is, this isn't the only mistake that you made, and maybe even tested him on other things. A person has to have a sense of where he's at. And if you take on the responsibility of teaching and you're not qualified for the position, then that's a very, very serious taina. The best and the brightest have to be involved in it. I am reminded of a story of a very, he's really a very wonderful man, I will not say his name, but one of the Balabatim in Miami. But he had his own perspective on life. And one time he's talking, he's complaining about his son. His son, as we say today, frumed out, you know. He sent him for a year in Israel, but he was expecting him to go back to college when he comes back, and now he's learning in Lakewood, and he wants to be a Rebbe. And the father was very, you know, he wanted his son to go into professions or business, you know. A very unusual scenario. And he said, I don't get it. My son is such a smart guy, such a bright guy. He could do anything. So I said to him, you mean that you should only go into chinuch, be a Rebbe, if you're not too bright? I suppose I should be insulted. Now, I have to hand it to the guy. He made one of the most astounding recoveries that I've ever seen. He said, well, your father is a rabbi. It makes sense for the son of a rabbi to be a rabbi. You know, somebody has to do it. You know, that's for rabbinic families. But I'm a businessman, so my son should be a businessman to support the institutions that you guys run. So I thought, it's a bright guy. It was a good recovery. But there is a certain attitude among some people. Well, sometimes it's buried. Like, all right, listen, if you can't do anything else, you know, all right, so be a teacher, be a mechanech. And that's really a recipe for a disaster, because it's such a tremendous responsibility and such a tremendous importance that it's after the people who are the most qualified that should be going into that. Okay.